Charges? She asked. I wrinkled my nose, shook my head. It looks like you have enough on your plate already. Chapter 50 Sammy Giamalva was having the nightmare again. The one where he's falling and falling, all the time bracing himself for an impact that never comes. It was the third time he'd had it in a week, so in some part of his brain, Sammy knew it was a dream. He opened his eyes to a completely different nightmare. This one was real. In the chair beside the bed sat a large man with the small, mean eyes of a pig. He wore a well-cut black suit. His legs were casually crossed as if he were a guest at a cocktail party. Instead of a drink, he held a gun which, like his awful smile, he aimed at Sammy. Get up, Sammy, the fixer said. I need a haircut. He jabbed the muzzle hard into Sammy's throat and nudged him down the stairs to the kitchen. Still training the gun at Sammy, the fixer settled into the large chair facing the long mirror. With the fingers of his free hand, he poked around in his thinning, light brown hair. What do you think is a good length for me, Sammy? He asked. If I go real short, I look like a Nazi. If I grow it long, I look like an asshole with a comb over. Shorter is better, Sammy tried to say, but his mouth was so dry it sounded more like a cough. You don't sound so sure, Sammy. I'm sure. This time Sammy managed to get the words out. He desperately tried to size up his situation. He was remembering what had happened to Peter, not to mention Fenton Gidley. This guy matched Fenton's description right down to the scar on his cheek. I guess you've already figured. I didn't come all the way out to Fag Harbor just to get a haircut. Sammy nodded and began to spread out the white plastic poncho for the haircut. He was trying to come up with a plan. Anything that would keep him alive. The man with the nasty eyes was cocky. Maybe that was something to play with. Is it because of what happened to the memory? Sammy spoke again. I've already taken care of that. That was no big whoop. I'm here about what happened at the beach. When Sammy responded with a puzzled look, the man said, Don't look so sad. All we want are the negatives. There's no point pretending anymore. The game's over. I win. You lose. The guy in his barber chair delivered these last words with an awful finality. This was worse than Sammy had thought. It wasn't about scaring him. It wasn't about the inquiry at all. Go ahead, said the fixer. I still need a haircut, and I'll take your advice on the length. Soon the man's hair was falling like a light snow on the plastic tarp spread out beneath the chair, and despite everything, Sammy fell into the calming, competent rhythm of his work. Snip and move and pull. Snip and move and pull. Forget that this guy has a gun in his hand. A simple phrase pulsed in his head. Do something or die. Do something or die. Sammy concentrated on his work as if his life depended on it, and when the fixer leaned forward in his chair so Sammy could pull off his plastic poncho, he couldn't help but be impressed. Now I know why those rich ladies drive all the way out here. Do something or die. One last spot, said Sammy, tapping him lightly on the shoulder. The man chuckled, then settled back in his chair. When he looked into the mirror, he saw Sammy's right hand blur across his chest. God damn it, he couldn't believe it. Not this puny little fag. Not here. Not like this. Oh, Jesus, no! The slice of the razor was so fast and clean, the fixer didn't know for sure if his throat had just been cut until he saw a second pink mouth flap open beneath his chin. Then, as the hairdresser reached from behind the chair and pinned his arms with a strength and fury that was the final surprise of his life, the fixer watched the life gush out of him. Who's going to fix this? Were his last five words. When Sammy released his hug, the large man slid out of the chair onto the plastic tarp on the floor. Sammy took a deep breath and tried to think this mess through. Fast. Jesus, he'd killed this guy. Nothing he could do about it now. Once he'd made up his mind, he went upstairs and packed. Then he went to the garage and siphoned a couple of gallons of Exxon Regular from his car. He waded down the cottage corner to corner, then he tossed in a flaming Zippo. By the time the first pumper truck arrived, that's exactly what was left of Sammy's soul kitchen. Zippo. Chapter 51. I was working up a few notes to give to Nadia Alper when I heard Mac's bellowing voice from downstairs.
Jack, come outside. Your girlfriend's here, pretty as ever, too.
Pauline was barely out of her car when Mac insisted she stay for dinner. About 10 minutes later, he announced he was abandoning us lovebirds to investigate the various offerings of Montauk's more reputable vegetable stands and fishmongers.
You are staying for supper, he told Pauline,
and she didn't bother to argue. 2.5 hours later, as the sun was losing its edge, he made his triumphant return. In one hand, he held the first local corn of the summer, in the other, 3 fat swordfish steaks.
Sal swears on the soul of his mother that he carved these out of a 350-pounder this morning, he boasted.
After unloading his treasure, he cracked open 3 beers and joined us on the deck, where we brought him up to speed on Pauline's latest discoveries about Barry Neubauer. After he listened to the dirt, Mac surveyed our respective strengths in food prep. Then he doled out assignments. I headed to the garage to dig out the old hibachi. He and Pauline disappeared into the kitchen. Just having Pauline around was making everyone happy. For the first time in ages, the place felt like a home instead of a dorm for lost boys. Mac was particularly euphoric. It was as if someone had slipped him a tab of ecstasy. Every once in a while, he'd wander out from the kitchen just to stand beside me and share his affection as I poked the coals. I know you're dying to tell me how much you love Pauline, so why don't you just get it off your chest, I said.
You should see her working on the salad dressing, Jackson. Madame Curie and cutoffs. I strongly urge you to marry this woman. Tonight, if possible.
I haven't even touched her yet.
Yeah, well, what's that about?
Macklin, can I ask you a personal question, just between us? Mullen to mullen?
But of course. Please do.
You think these coals are ready?
I talk to you of the longings of the human heart, and you ask me about coal. Cook the damn fish, Jack. Show how you can do something right.
I like her, all right? I finally said in an exasperated voice.
That's not good enough, Jack. This one deserves more than like.
Mac, I know what she deserves. 30 minutes later, we all sat down on the back porch to a perfect summer dinner. Everything turned out just right. The swordfish, the corn, the wine. Even Pauline's salad dressing lived up to the hype. We were all a little laid back after the meal. I looked at Mac's ragged map of a face. It seemed to be lit from within, like a lantern. Pauline looked more relaxed and lovelier than I'd ever seen her. Mac drew Pauline out about her childhood in Michigan. She told us that her old man was a retired Detroit cop and her mother taught English in an inner-city high school. Most of her aunts and uncles were auto workers.
How'd your parents meet?
Asked Mac, still persistently stirring the conversation. My father is my mother's second husband, said Pauline. Her first was this big, bad, charismatic dude from the old neighborhood named Alvin Craig. Craig was a drag racer, a brawler, always in and out of trouble with the law, and once, when he was drinking, he beat my mother up. The last time he tried to do it, she was 5 months pregnant with me. She called the cops. The cop who arrived at the house was a big, tough guy, too. He took one look at my mother and he asked Alvin if they could talk outside for a little bit. My parents lived in a tiny row house, and for about an hour, Alvin and the cop sat on the stoop out front. There was no fighting, no yelling. Neither one even raised his voice. When they got up, Alvin went upstairs, threw his stuff in 2 suitcases, and left for good. The cop stayed for coffee, and a few months later, my mother had a new husband. I might never have known the real story except that one day when I was 15 and acting like a total brat, I called my father an asshole. My mother was furious. She decided it was time I learned how they met and fell in love. They're a sweet couple, actually. It was an impossible story to top, so Mac didn't even try, but he offered childhood tales of his own, including the time he and his best mate, Tommy McGoey, hopped a lorry and spent 3 days walking around Dublin, sleeping under wagons and living on stolen milk and rolls, mesmerized by everything they laid eyes on. Pauline had inspired him to dredge up stories that were even new to me. That's the kind of serenely magical night it was, when friendship feels as solid as family, and family as light and untroubled as friendship. I suppose it was too sweet to last. Just before midnight, we heard a car door slam in the driveway, then the sound of shoes scraping on the gravel. When I turned to look, Dana was walking toward us like a long, blonde ghost.
"Ah, speak of the devil," said Mac.
Chapter 52. For 30 excruciating seconds, the eye contact around the table was as fast and furious as a kabuki drama.
"Don't all act too excited to see me," Dana said finally. She turned toward the dark-haired stranger.
"I'm Dana, Jack's girlfriend, I think."
"Pauline."
After extending an urgent, conciliatory shrug toward Pauline, I turned to my self-described girlfriend. "Pauline's a very good friend from Nelson Goodwin and Mickle," I said, and regretted it instantly.
"Where I understand you're no longer employed."
"They offered me a golden parachute."
"So what do you do there?"
Dana asked Pauline. "Are you a lawyer?"
"I'm an investigator," said Pauline, her voice flat and neutral.
"What do you investigate?"
"You sound like an investigator yourself," said Pauline, the warmth and openness of the evening a memory now.
"Sorry, just trying to make a little awkward conversation."
As for Mac, he still hadn't said a word. To make it absolutely clear which side of the fence he was on, he hadn't even looked at Dana. He hadn't looked at me either, but I didn't have to see his face to know how upset he was, and that he considered this my fault. Pauline, having sat through enough of this bad soap opera, rose to leave.
"Dinner was delicious," she said, smiling at Mac. "So was everything else."
"You were the best part of it by far, Polly girl," said Mac, standing and giving her a long hug. "Let me walk you to your car."
"You don't have to leave," I said.
"Oh, but I do," said Pauline. Then she and Mac took off arm in arm, almost as if Dana and I weren't there.
"Let me walk with you, Pauline," I said. "Please, I need to talk to you."
"No," said Pauline without turning to face me. "You stay and talk to your girlfriend. I'm sure you two have a lot to catch up on."
Chapter 53.
"I hope I didn't interrupt anything," Dana said.
Her mouth was in a pout, but her eyes were smiling slyly.
"Yeah, right. What are you doing here, Dana?"
"Well, you can't expect a girl to give up without a fight," she said, with one of her more charming, self-effacing smiles.
"You haven't seen or spoken to me in almost 2 months. It was your idea, remember?"
"I know that, Jack. I was in Paris. And Florence, Barcelona. I needed some time to think."
"So, Dana, what did you figure out in Europe? That you don't like yourself as much as you thought you did?"
"You've put me in an impossible position, Jack. It's you or my father."
"A no-brainer, obviously. Daddy treated you to Europe, right?"
"Sometimes you don't know what you're talking about, Jack. My father is a wonderful man in many ways. He's great to my mom. He's blindly supported me in anything I've ever tried to do. Plus, he's my goddamn dad. What do you want from me?"
Her filial loyalty actually made me miss my own father.
"So what brings you here tonight?"
"You,"
said Dana, staring at me intently.
"I missed you even more than I thought I would. You are special, Jack."
When she touched my arm, I almost jumped.
God, you hate me, don't you? Tears welled in her eyes. Oh, Jack, don't you have anything to say to me?
I guess you've heard about the inquiry, I said. Her head jerked back, the blonde hair flying.
I can't believe anyone really thinks my family had anything to do with Peter's death. Do you, Jack? What makes you even think Peter was murdered?
His body was covered with bruises, Dana. He was beaten on your beach. I wish you'd seen him.
A lot of people think the storm could have done that.
I still couldn't quite believe that Dana had gone completely over to the other side, but I knew it would be insane to share any of the hard work Pauline and I had done.
Dana, you weren't around when I really needed you, and I did need you, I told her.
Tears were running down her cheeks.
I'm sorry, Jack. What do I have to do to prove it to you?
You said some things before you left. Then you never called or wrote, not even a postcard. Now you just show up here. She wiped her face.
Jack, let's go someplace. We could get a room at the memory. Please, I need to talk to you.
She reached out, put her arms around me. It felt way beyond wrong. I pulled away.
I'm not going to the memory, Dana. I think you should leave.
She folded her arms and stared at me angrily. The transformation was quite amazing.
So, who is she, Jack? The bitch who was here before.
A very good friend. She's helping me with the case.
That reminds me, how's Volpe?
Dana flinched, then jumped up out of her chair. She wasn't sniffling anymore. Now she was just pissed off. Daddy's little girl was a lot like Daddy. Once Dana was gone, I went inside the house, past a sullen Mac watching the Yankees-Red Sox game, and tried to reach Pauline on her cell phone. Either she turned it off, or she wouldn't take my call.
Chapter 54.
I took a Guinness out to the front porch and watched the late departing weekenders head back to the city. Soon the Hamptons would be safe again for dreamy-eyed townies. In the meantime, I sat on the cool flagstones and rewound the evening. What a friggin' disaster. I even began to wonder if Dana had known Pauline was here. I wouldn't have put it past her. It was getting late, and watching the passing SUVs was like counting sheep. I was fading a little when a police car screeched around the corner against the westbound traffic. To my surprise, it turned into our driveway and skidded to a stop. Frank Volpe and a sergeant I didn't recognize hopped out. What the hell?
Mind if I ask you a couple of questions?
Asked Volpe as he reached the porch. Does it matter what I think, Frank?
Not really. Where have you been tonight?
Here? Why?
Someone just torched Sammy Giamalva's house to the ground,
he said.
Professional. We're pretty sure with him in it.
I felt as if I'd been hit with the kitchen skillet. I thought of the photographs of Sammy in his kitchen, the ones that were dropped off at the memory. Sammy with a cigarette in his mouth and a cup of coffee in his hand. It showed a live wire 21-year-old getting stoked to do something he loved, a portrait of the stylist as a young man. Then I flashed on the tiny pairs of numbers scribbled in pencil under each photo. I suddenly realized they were odds, and that Sammy's 6-5 were the shortest. Volpe was still in my face.
Is there anyone who can confirm you've been here for the last couple of hours?
What is it, Frank? You really think I burnt down Sammy's house? With my family gone, I'm turning on my friends? As mad as I was, it was nothing compared to my panic about the danger I'd put my friends in.
Mind if Officer Jordan and I have a look around?
Volpe asked.
Actually, I do, I said, but Jordan was already heading for the garage.
Hey, I called.
You can't go in there!
I followed and stood beside him as he pulled up the door and swept his flashlight over the cluttered space. The beam moved slowly over the deep blue sheen of Peter's motorcycle.
That's one pretty scooter, he said with a smirk. Almost 20 grand, isn't it?
What you're doing here is illegal, I said. Come on, huh? Get out of the garage. He bent down to open the immaculate little BMW toolbox. What the hell was he looking for? I stepped forward and grabbed his arm.
I'd appreciate it if you'd leave right now. Get away from the bike.
Jordan came out of his crouch and jumped into my chest, knocking me back into Frank Volpe. who'd followed us into the garage. Volpe immediately grabbed my arms. He let Jordan take it from there. If the first punch didn't re-break my almost healed rib, the second definitely did.
You're under arrest for interfering with a police investigation and assaulting a police officer, said Volpe.
He grinned as he cuffed me and dragged me out to the car. He didn't bother to read my rights, and I got the message. I didn't have any. Chapter 55.
Wakey, wakey.
A tin cup, rattling over steel bars, startled me from a dream in which I was trying to save Peter and Sammy. I jumped up and frantically scanned the cell. Then I saw Mac's shit-eating grin, and the small, greased-stained paper bag under his arm, and the old metal camping cup in his hand, which he must have spent all morning searching for.
Get out of bed, you lazy so-and-so. I just bailed you out.
Good to see you, Macklin. And thanks for that little prison riot vignette. I threw on my clothes, and Paul Infante, the cop who'd worked the overnight shift, appeared in front of the cell. He extended a key attached to his belt by a long, thin chain, and the big bolt toppled over with an echoing clang. He pulled the heavy door toward him, and I stepped back out into the world.
Jack Hurricane Mullen, said Macklin, clapping me on the shoulder. Not even 6 hours in the East Hampton Hilton could break this man.
Can it, Macklin? Upstairs, Infante gave me an envelope with my watch and wallet in it, and I signed a summons pledging to appear in court for interfering with a police investigation. The assault charge had been dropped.
We should go visit Sammy's mom this afternoon, Mac said somberly. We're the only ones who know how she feels.
I suppose they're going to say that was an accident too, I said. Maybe a suicide? I described the visit from Volpe and Jordan, how unbelievably brazen and cocky they'd been. Can they get away with it? I asked him.
Sure. Looks like they just did.
As I pulled out of the driveway, I plucked the bag of Dreesen donuts off Mac's lap. There were three inside, dark, soft, and sprinkled with cinnamon. If it's possible, I think spending my first night in jail made them taste even better.
So, tell me something, said Mac,
snatching the last donut before it reached my lips.
You still feel like the man who's going to bring the goddamn system to its knees?
Chapter 56. I was about to find out. The inquiry into my brother's death was held in the gymnasium of the Montauk Middle School. They couldn't have picked a worse spot. For years, Peter and I used to play Sunday pickup games there. Every Sunday. Walking to my seat with Mac, I could still hear the deep smack of basketballs echoing off the whitewashed cinder block. As I took a seat, I remembered the very first weekend we ever snuck inside the gym as kids. Fenton got hold of a key, and after stashing our bikes in the woods, we crowded around him as he slipped it into the lock. Miraculously, it fit. We stepped through the small side door into the hushed, voluminous darkness, more awed than if we'd just snuck into St. Patrick's Cathedral. Hank found the switch, and the entire trespassed interior, with its gleaming hardwood floor and white fiberglass backboards, lit up like a technicolor dream. On the morning of the inquest, at least 200 folding chairs were set up in long rows across the court. The people who sat in them had all been here before, either as graduating students or proud parents or both. Marcy had saved Mac and me the last two seats in the front row. I looked around and saw Fenton and Molly, Hank and his wife, an incredible number of friends from town. But not poor Sammy Giamalva, of course. We didn't have to wait very long for the action to begin.
Hear ye, hear ye,
proclaimed the bailiff who had driven up that morning from Riverhead.
All persons having business before the Supreme Court of Suffolk County, please give your attention to the Honorable Judge Robert P. Lillian.
In his stark black robe, the judge looked like a commencement day speaker. He entered the gym from the small cafeteria directly behind it and took his elevated seat. Spectator-wise,
It may have been a local crowd, but at the business end, the manpower balance tilted heavily in the opposite direction. Sitting shoulder to shoulder at a long, thin table facing the judge were three Nelson, Goodwin, and Mickles senior partners, led by none other than Bill Montrose. Sitting behind him, like proud sons, were three of the firm's most promising associates. At the opposing table sat 31-year-old district attorney Nadia Alper and four empty chairs. Alper sucked at a jumbo Coke and jotted notes on a yellow pad.
"She doesn't even have a cut, man," observed Mac.
Lillian, a short, sturdy man in his late 50s, informed us from his judicial pulpit that although there was no defendant, the day-long inquest would proceed like a juryless trial. Witnesses would be called to testify under oath. Limited cross-examination would be permitted as he deemed relevant. In other words, he was God. He turned the floor over to Neubauer's legal team, and Montrose summoned one Tricia Powell, a blousy, dark-haired woman in her 20s. I'd never seen Powell before, and wondered where she fit in. With Montrose's guidance, Tricia Powell testified that she had been a guest at the Neubauer's Memorial Day weekend party. Near the end of the evening, she had strolled down to the water.
"See anyone on your walk?" questioned Montrose.
"Not until I got to the beach," said Powell. "That's when I saw Peter Mullen." I flinched in my seat. This was the first indication in 2 months that anyone had seen Peter after his dinner break. It sent a ripple of whispers through the gym.
"What was he doing when you saw him?" asked Montrose.
"Staring into the waves," said Powell. "He looked sad."
"Did you know who he was?"
"No, but I recognized him as the man who had parked my car. Then, of course, I saw his picture in the paper."
"What happened that night? Tell us exactly what you saw."
"I smoked a cigarette and started to head back. But as I did, I heard a splash, and I turned to see Peter Mullen swimming through the waves."
"Did that strike you as unusual?"
"Oh, absolutely. Not only because of the size of the waves, but also how cold the water was. I had stuck my toe in and was shocked."
So was I. This woman, whoever she was lying her ass off. I leaned toward Nadia Alper and whispered a quick message.
When Montrose finished, Alper got up to question Powell.
"How is it that you know Barry Neubauer?" she asked.
"We're colleagues," Powell said, cool as could be. I wanted to go up there and slap her.
"You're also in the toy business, Miss Powell?"
"I work in the promotions department at Mayflower Enterprises."
"In other words, you work for Barry Neubauer?"
"I like to think we're friends, too."
"I'm sure you will be now,"
said Nadia Alper.
The derisive laughter in the gym was cut off by a sharp reprimand from Lillian.
"I trust, Miss Alper, that I will not have to ask you again to refrain from editorial asides."
She turned back to the witness.
"I have a list here of everyone who was invited to the party that evening. Your name isn't on that list, Miss Powell. Any idea why?"
"I met Mr. Neubauer at a meeting a couple of days before. He was kind enough to invite me."
"I see. And what time did you arrive?"
asked Nadia. "Unfashionably early, I confess. 7 o'clock, maybe 5 after at the latest. With all the celebrities, I didn't want to miss a minute."
"And it was Peter Mullen who parked your car?"
"Yes."
"You're absolutely positive, Miss Powell?"
"Positive. He was memorable."
Alper went to her desk, grabbed a folder, and approached the bench.
"I would like to submit to the court written statements from 3 of Peter Mullen's co-workers that evening. They state that the deceased got to work at least 40 minutes late. Therefore, it was impossible for him to have parked Miss Powell's or anyone else's car before 7:40.
The crowd stirred again. The whispers got louder. People were clearly angry.
"Do you have any explanation for this discrepancy, Miss Powell?"
asked the judge.
"I thought he parked my car, Your Honor. I suppose it's possible I saw him at some other point in the party. He was very good looking. Maybe that's why his face stuck out of my mind."
The
There was so much commotion as Nadia Aylper returned to her seat that Lillian had to bang his gavel and ask for quiet again.
"Aylper's got some brass," said Mac in my ear. "I'd score that round a draw."
Chapter 57. This was excruciating. I wanted to be the one handling the cross-examination, objecting to Bill Montrose's every sentence, his blasé attitude, even his goddamn blue cashmere blazer and gunmetal gray slacks. He looked like he was on his way to the bath and tennis club as soon as this trifling matter was finished. Montrose's next witness was Dr. Aishir Jacobson, who had quit his position as Los Angeles County Coroner a decade ago when he realized he could do five times as well as an expert witness.
"Dr. Jacobson, how long did you serve as chief pathologist at Cook Claremont Hospital in Los Angeles?"
21 years, sir."
"And in that time, doctor, approximately how many drowning victims were you called upon to examine?"
"A great many, I'm sorry to say. Los Angeles area beaches are extremely active and crowded with surfers. In my tenure, I looked into over 200 drownings."
Montrose gleamed up at Judge Lillian, then back to Dr. Jacobson.
"So it's no exaggeration to say that this is an area in which you have an exceptional level of expertise?"
"I believe I've examined more drowning victims than any active pathologist in the United States."
"And what were your conclusions concerning the death of Peter Mullen?"
"First of all, that he drowned. Secondly, that his death was either an accident or a suicide."
"It's not as if I didn't know how easily expert testimony can be purchased. If the client can afford to, he can always fly in a second opinion to forcefully contradict whatever the prosecution is putting out. The injuncture, the lawyer's artifice, just seems a little different when the murder victim is your brother."
"How do you explain the condition of the body, Dr. Jacobson? Pictures taken of the deceased after he washed ashore indicate that he was badly bruised, and there's been speculation that he was beaten."
"As you know, a storm was passing through the Hamptons that weekend. In that kind of surf, a badly bruised corpse is the rule, not the exception. I've examined dozens of drowning victims where foul play was never a question. Believe me, they looked at least as battered as Peter Mullen did that night. Some were worse."
"That's total bullshit," said Hank, leaning over the backs of our seats. "This guy's sickening. Bought and paid for."
Montrose continued with the charade. He was sickening too.
"As you know, I asked you to bring some pictures of previous victims to illustrate this point. Could you share these with the court, Dr. Jacobson?"
Jacobson held up two pictures of Montrose, as if he hadn't seen them before, winced.
"Both of the surfers were approximately the same age as Mr. Mullen," Jacobson said. "As you can see, they are almost as badly bruised as Mr. Mullen, and as I recall, the conditions were not nearly as severe."
Montrose carried the photographs to the judge, who placed them beside the statements he had received from Alper.
"Is there anything else you found in the records that could shed light on his tragic death?"
asked Monty. Jacobson nodded.
"The autopsy revealed significant traces of marijuana in his bloodstream, as if he had inhaled one or maybe two marijuana cigarettes shortly before entering the water."
"Your Honor," interrupted Alper, "this shameless effort to taint the reputation of the victim has been going on since he died. When does it stop?"
"Please, Miss Alper," said the judge. "Sit down and wait your turn."
"Why might this marijuana be relevant, Dr. Jacobson?"
asked Montrose.
"Recent studies have shown that immediately after using marijuana, the risk of heart failure increases dramatically. Add to that a water temperature in the low 50s, and it becomes a real possibility. I believe that's exactly what happened here."
"Thank you, Dr. Jacobson. I have no further questions."
Chapter 58. This whole thing was suddenly too much for me to take. If I had been the DA, I would have cross-examined Dr. Jacobson until he was bleeding from every orifice.
I would have asked him to tell the court how many days of expert testimony he had billed Nelson, Goodwin, and Mickle for in the past 5 years, 48, what his day rate, $7,500, and per diem, $300, were, and to name his favorite restaurant in New York, Gotham Bar and Grill, most expensive entree, Via L'Esplanade, $48. To belabor the point, I'd have asked if those 48 days qualified him for Nelson, Goodwin, and Mickle's pension plan. No. If he got to keep his bonus miles, also no. And if he had ever delivered an expert opinion other than the ones he was paid for. Of course not. Nadia Ilper chose not to pursue this hard line of questioning. Maybe she assumed that Lillian would have cut her off. Perhaps she thought that the sooner we got our own expert on the stand, the better. Whatever the reasons, the gym swelled with righteous indignation when she called Dr. Jane Davis to the stand. At last, we were going to listen to testimony that hadn't been bought, and Montauk would hear from one of its own. This was why we had come to this inquest, to hear the truth for a change. Even Nadia Ilper looked in better spirits as she asked,
"Dr. Davis, please tell us your role in this investigation."
"I'm the pathologist for Huntington Hospital and chief medical examiner for Suffolk County," Jane said.
"So, unlike Dr. Jacobson, you actually examined Peter Mullen's body, is that correct?"
"Yes."
"How many hours did you devote to his examination?"
"Over 60.
"Is that more than usual?"
"I grew up in Montauk, and I knew the Mullen family, so I was particularly thorough," said Jane.
"What evidence did you consider?"
asked Ilper. "In addition to an extensive physical examination of the corpse, I took multiple x-rays and sampled and compared lung tissues."
"And according to your report, which I have in my hand, you concluded that Mr. Mullen did not drown at all but was beaten to death. To quote from your report, Peter Mullen's death was the result of multiple blows to the neck and head with fists, feet, or other blunt instruments. X-rays show two completely severed vertebrae, and the level of saturation of the lung tissues indicates the victim had stopped breathing well before he reached the water."
"Those were my findings," said Davis, who seemed nervous and now drew a deep breath. "But upon further consideration and soul-searching, and the benefit of Dr. Jacobson's extensive experience, I've concluded that those initial findings were incorrect, that the evidence does point towards drowning. I realize now that my judgment was compromised by my closeness to the family of the deceased." As Jane Davis delivered this last bit of devastating testimony, her voice was paper thin and she seemed to shrivel up on the stand. She left Ilper standing there twisting in the wind, speechless. I couldn't believe what I just heard either. Neither could the crowd in the gym. Heads were swiveling everywhere.
"How much did they pay you, darling?"
asked a woman whose son had been in Peter's class.
"I hope it was more than they paid Dr. Jacobson," shouted Bob Shaw, who owns the deli on Main. "He didn't have to sell out his friends." "Leave her alone," Macklin finally spoke from his seat. "They got to her. They threatened her. Hell, can't you see that?"
Lillian pounded his gavel and yelled for quiet, and when that had no effect, he announced a one-hour recess. In the near riot, Jane Davis had already left the stand. I ran after her, but her car was tearing out of the rear lot. Chapter 59. Mac and I staggered out of the gym for the recess. At the side parking lot, we took refuge on a small bench. I felt like I'd just taken another beating, only this was worse than any of the others.
"You've probably learned more in the last 3 hours than in 2 years at your Ivy League law school," said Mac. "Unless they're offering tutorials on witness tampering, bribery, and physical intimidation. Maybe they should."
He looked out at the lovely August morning and spat between his shapeless black brogans. In a lot of ways, this was an idyllic scene. A nice, well-maintained little school, green playing fields up the wazoo. It was the kind of spot TV stations like to send camera crews to on election mornings, capture the picturesque machinery of democracy at work,
film the local people filing into their small-town gymnasium in their heavy work boots, stepping behind the curtain to cast their votes. When you come to the same gym on a morning like this, you realize something is going on, and that it isn't pretty, isn't idyllic, and it certainly isn't democratic. It's the big lie, the white noise, the matrix. Marcy spotted us on the bench and came over for a smoke.
Those New York City folks don't take any prisoners, do they?
She said, holding out her pack. I shook my head.
Sure. It's a great day for a life-shortening habit, said Marcy.
When I was a grad school student, looking out at this same parking lot, it was usually empty except for a modest row of cars belonging to the teachers. As I looked now, a Mercedes sedan slowly circled the blacktop. Long and silver with blackened-out windows, it finally stopped 20 yards away from us. Burly, dark-suited men hopped out of the front. They hustled to open the rear doors. In a flash of long, white legs and blonde hair, Dana stepped out. She was tugging on her dark dress, and I have to admit, she looked as good as ever. Around the other side of the car came her father. He looked great, too, all powerful and knowing. He took her hand, and with the bodyguards deployed front and back, the two walked toward the gym.
"Why, it's your old girlfriend," said Mac. "I must have pegged her wrong, because here she is to show her support for you and your brother."
Chapter 60 Marcy rubbed out her cigarette, and we followed the Neubauers and their bodyguards back into the gym. Judge Lillian was attempting to call the room to order. He banged his gavel several times, and the Montauketeers cut off their bitter discussions and trudged back to their metal chairs. They were just settling in when Montrose called Dana Neubauer to the stand. My stomach sank.
"God in heaven," mumbled Mac. "What could she have to say?"
Dana walked solemnly to the stand. As I said, she looked particularly stunning that morning. In retrospect, I realized she also looked substantial, serious, and totally credible.
"Did you know the deceased, Peter Mullen?" Montrose asked.
"Yes, I knew Peter very well," she said.
"For how long?"
"I've been coming here every summer for 21 years. I met Peter and the rest of his family early on."
"I'm sorry to have to ask this, Dana, but were you ever intimately involved with Peter Mullen?"
Dana nodded. "Yes."
There was some murmuring, but overall, the room was still reeling from all the other testimony. I knew about Dana and Peter by now, but I hated to hear it in open court.
"How long did the relationship last?"
he asked.
"About 6 months," said Dana, shifting uncomfortably in her chair.
Montrose sighed, as if this was as hard for him as it was for Dana.
"Were you involved at the time of his death?"
"Oh, Jesus," I was thinking. "This just keeps getting worse."
"We had just broken up," said Dana,
looking in my direction. I knew it was a lie. At least I thought it was. But when I tried to meet her eye, she looked back at Montrose.
"How recently?"
he asked.
"I know this is hard for you."
"That night," said Dana in a stage whisper. "The night of the party."
"What a wonderful girl you got there, Jack,"
said Mac, without bothering to look over at me. Dana flashed me another fearful look and started to cry softly. I stared back in awe. Who was this woman on the stand? Was any of this true?
"Peter took it really badly," she resumed. "He started acting crazy. He broke a lamp in the house, knocked over a chair, and stormed out. He called an hour later and told me I was making a big mistake, that the two of us had to be together. I knew he was upset, but I never thought he'd do anything rash. If you knew Peter, you wouldn't have believed it either. He acted like nothing ever really got to him. Obviously, I was wrong. I'm so sorry about what happened."
Then Dana put her head down and sobbed into her hands.
"Bravo!" Fenton called from a few rows behind. "Bravissimo!"
Then he jumped up and began clapping wildly for Dana's breathtaking performance.
Chapter 61. A good friend of mine once spent a summer interning at a New York TV news station. The anchorman liked him and over a beer offered the secret to on-air success. "The whole thing in this business," said the anchor, "is sincerity. Once you learn how to fake that, the rest is easy." Barry Neubauer followed Dana to the stand. Neubauer's specialty wasn't feigning empathy, but projecting CEO-ness. Every detail of his presentation, from the cut of his charcoal suit to the tilt of his jaw to his full head of gray hair, reinforced the message that here was a man who was your superior.
"Mr. Neubauer," Nadia Alper began, "according to a bartender who was setting up at your place the afternoon before the party, you and Mrs. Neubauer engaged in a lengthy and nasty argument. Could you tell us what the argument was about?"
"I do recall a spat," said Neubauer with a shrug. "But I don't remember it as being particularly serious. In fact, I have no clear recollection of what it was about. Probably just pre-party anxiety. I suspect that bartender hasn't been married for 27 years.
"Would it jog your memory, Mr. Neubauer, if I told you that the same bartender heard you say the name Peter Mullen several times in the course of the argument, often with an expletive attached?"
Neubauer frowned as he strained to recall the incident.
"No, I'm sorry, it wouldn't. I can't imagine any circumstances in which his name would come up in an argument between Campion and myself. Peter Mullen has been a friend of the family for as long as I can remember. We consider his death, whatever the exact circumstances, extremely tragic. I've extended my condolences to the Mullen family. I visited his older brother, Jack, at the law firm where he worked and spoke to him at length."
As a witness, Neubauer had what might be described as perfect pitch. His erect posture, steady gaze, deep voice, and slow, thoughtful delivery all combined to create an impression of absolute credibility. To judge his responses as anything less than the truth seemed cynical and conspiratorial. Alper persisted. To her credit, she didn't seem afraid of him.
"Could you recall your activities on the day Mr. Mullen died?"
"I screened some dailies in the morning and played 18 holes rather badly at Maidstone in the afternoon. Then Campion and I got ourselves ready for the party."
"Could you tell us what you were doing at about 10:30 that night, the time that Mr. Mullen died?"
"I was in an upstairs den on the phone," said Neubauer, without hesitation. "This I remember very well."
Nadia Elper tilted her head in surprise. So did Mac and I.
"Is there a reason, Mr. Neubauer, why you remember a phone call so vividly, yet have no recollection about a fight with your wife?"
Nothing seemed to shake Barry Neubauer.
"For one thing, it was a very long call. A little more than an hour. I even remember feeling very guilty about being away from our guests so long."
"He's just a goddamn caring human being," said Macklin under his breath.
"Do you have any proof of the call?"
"Yes, I've brought a copy of the phone bill. It shows a 74-minute call from 10:03 to 11:17 p.m.
Neubauer passed the record to Alper.
"Could you tell us who you were talking to, Mr. Neubauer?" asked Alper.
When Neubauer hesitated slightly, Montrose barked,
"Objection!"
Both attorneys looked toward Lillian.
"Denied," said the judge. "Please answer the question." "Robert Crassweller, Jr.," said Neubauer.
The slightest trace of a smile crossed his lips.
"The Attorney General of the United States," he said.
This final answer drained whatever energy and tension remained in the courtroom. Some spectators got up and left, like this was an Islander game and the fat lady had just sung. Barry Neubauer's eyes casually roamed the audience. When he found me, he offered up a lazy smile. "Amateur hour is over, boys." After a few more questions, Nadia Alper excused Neubauer. Then both lawyers informed the court that they had presented their list of witnesses. Judge Lillian made a show of adjusting his robes before somberly addressing the court.
Normally, said Lillian, I would withhold my decision until the morning. In this case, however, I can't think of anything that requires further reflection. It is the finding of this inquiry court that on 29 May 2000, Peter Mullen drowned by accident or suicide. This inquest is now completed and this courtroom adjourned.
Chapter 62. The court adjourned at about 20 to 5. When I got to the shagwang, it was 5 on the nose. I took a seat at the end of the bar and asked Mike to pour out 6 shots of Jameson. Without raising an eyebrow, he grabbed 2 handfuls of glasses and, with practiced precision, lined them up and filled them to the rim.
They're on me, he said.
I would have asked for 7 then, I told him. I smiled for the first time that day. Mike put down a 7th and filled it.
I was joking.
Me too.
As Mike laid out my full course of Irish medicine, I saw again that smug little smile Montrose flashed me on his way out of the courtroom. It showed more disgust than joy. Why, he seemed to be asking, why was I the only one in the room who couldn't understand that justice is neither a mystery nor a crapshoot, but a major purchase? Spend your money thoughtfully and secretly, you walk free. That was the way it was in America these days. Who knows? Maybe it had always been that way. Over the next 1.5 to 2 hours, I steadily worked from left to right. I tossed back shots for each bot witness in the parade of perjurers. I lifted a glass to Tricia Powell, no doubt the Mayflower Employee of the Month, and another for the good Dr. Jacobson, the coroner magician from Los Angeles, or, as Mac described him, a whore with a resume. My old honey Dana rated 2 shots of Jameson, the first for coming all the way back from Europe just because she missed me, the second for her Oscar-worthy performance that afternoon. Hardly acknowledging anyone around me, I sipped and stewed until my level of numbness nudged ahead of my rage. I think that happened somewhere around my 2nd Dana shot, my 4th in 40 minutes. Although I'm probably not the most reliable witness, I recall that Fenton and Hank came up and threw an arm around me, but sensing I wasn't up for a group hug, soon left me to myself medicating. They were just trying to do the right thing. When I'd put in my order, I'd counted on a toast for Jane Davis, but by the time her turn came, I was more worried about her than angry. On the way back from the bathroom, I stopped at the payphone and left a slightly incoherent message on her machine.
"It's not your fault, Jane," I shouted over the din. "It's mine. I never should have gotten you into this mess."
That was when I saw none other than Frank Volpe. He was standing in back, waiting for me to get off the phone.
"Congratulations, asshole," he said.
Then he grinned and walked away before I could get off a shot. Back at the bar, I toasted Frank. He'd been there for us from the start, and his performance had been flawless.
"Volpe,"
I said and drank.
Numero 6 was for Barry Neubauer himself. The river of whiskey had opened up my poetic side, and I came up with a couplet for the occasion. Barry Neubauer, scumbag of the hour. That was meant to be my last, but thanks to Mike, I had one glistening silver bullet left. I was afraid I was going to have to drink to something vague and amorphous like the system. Then I thought of Attorney General Robert Crassweller Jr. Even I had to hand it to Montrose for the way he set up the big punchline with his phony objection. What panache. He had played Nadia Ilper like a Stradivarius. What class. What a winner. After the last toast, the vertical and horizontal on my picture started to wander. In fact, the whole room was spinning. I treated the problem with a couple of beers. Hair of the dog. Then I made a few attempts to leave Mike a $40 tip. He kept stuffing it back in my shirt pocket until I finally stumbled out the door. 2 blocks later, I stopped at a payphone and called Jane again. That awful look on her face wouldn't go away. I was planning to leave a slightly more intelligible version of my first message when she answered.
"It's okay, Jane," I said.
"No, it's
not okay. Jesus, Jack. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. They came to my house.
It wouldn't have made an iota of difference.
So what?
She sounded hysterical. Four weekenders walked by and got into a Saab convertible.
Jane, you've got to swear to me you won't do anything stupid.
Don't worry. But there's something I have to tell you. I didn't before because I didn't see the point. When I did all those tests on Peter, I also did blood tests.
Jack, your brother was HIV positive.
Chapter 63. The 2-mile walk in the ocean air did me a world of good. By the time I passed the parking lot for Ditch Plains Beach and cut across my damp lawn, I was close to sober again. It's something I'll always be grateful for. Because sitting on the porch, leaning back against the front door in one of my old tattered sweaters, was Pauline. It was around 10:30. The street and lawn were enveloped in a light ocean mist. It's a weird analogy, and I have no idea why I thought of it, but seeing Pauline blocking my path to the door brought to mind Gary Cooper waiting patiently in the street in high noon. Something about her stillness and her, "Here I am, what are you going to do about it?" smile.
You're a sight for sore eyes, Pauline.
You too, Jack. I watched from the back of the gym today. Then I drove all the way back to the city. Then I drove all the way back out here. Crazy, huh? Don't try to deny it. Did you do something awful that made Macklin kick you out of the house?
No.
You just wanted some fresh air?
No.
Am I getting warm?
No.
Most no's aren't too good, but these were about as good as no's could be. I sat on the cool flagstone and leaned back against the red wooden door of our house. I touched Pauline's arm. It felt electric against mine. She took my hand in hers and my mouth went dry. But as I was talking to Macklin, something became really clear to me, she whispered.
What was that, Pauline?
I whispered back.
How much I care about you.
I looked at her again and did what I'd probably wanted to do for a long time. I kissed her gently on the lips. They were soft and fit perfectly on mine. We stayed that way for a sweet moment before we pulled back and looked at each other.
That was worth the wait, I said.
You shouldn't have waited, Jack. I promise I won't wait as long for the next one. We started kissing again and haven't really stopped since. Now I appreciate for those of you who have stayed with me this far, there's nothing too surprising about this romantic development. You probably saw it coming, but I didn't. Not until I walked across the lawn that night. Not because I didn't want it to happen. I wanted it to happen from the first moment Pauline walked into my tiny office. I wanted it so badly I was afraid to even hope for it.
You're a good person. And sweet, Pauline said as we hugged on the front porch.
Try not to hold it against me.
I won't.